fats are good. Greens are bad. Greens are good. Eggs are good. Eggs are bad. Seems like nothing flies faster these days than a food fad. And so we ask, can our taste tell good food from bad?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there, folks. You are tuned into the 1009th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Elias Caius who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with somebody in the production room.
It's me, I admit it. It's Jason.
Folks, this from Voltaire. Nothing would be more tiresome than eating and drinking if God had not made them a pleasure as well as a necessity. We do love to eat. We love to eat things that taste good. That said, where does this notion, this confusion as to why some things taste good and other things not so good? In fact, nothing flies faster these days than a food fad. Everybody knows what everybody else should eat, and everybody tells them, and everybody listens. So round and round we go. Fats are bad. Fats are good. Greens are good. Greens are bad. Eggs are bad. Eggs are good. But wait, how did we survive all the millennia of eating whatever we could scrounge from nature without everybody telling everybody else what they should eat? Could it be that our God-given, evolution-tuned sense of taste somehow allowed us to safely eat our way through thousands of years of rotting meat, molding grains, and squirming grubs? That question leads us to ask another. Can taste tell the good food from the bad? Well, here today to help us test some taste answers, we have none other than Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Andy John McQuaid, who is the author of Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat. Welcome to the Food Chain, John. Are you there?
Yes.
We have you there. Good to go. Author of Tasty. So, you know, I've done 1,009 radio shows on food and agriculture, and I've never focused a single show on taste. What was that epiphany moment when you, as a journalist, decided, wow, let's take a look at this taste?
Well, I have two kids and was engaged in a constant struggle to feed them because they're both picky eaters and their pickiness did not overlap. So my son liked and still likes really spicy foods like super hot peppers, and he would eat limes, you know, basically just chop them up and pop the pieces into his mouth. My daughter, on the other hand, preferred very bland comfort type foods, you know, like mac and cheese, white foods, you know, pasta, rice, cheese, stuff like that. So, and so I wondered why, you know, this was a constant struggle to, you know, feed them and get them to eat a good diet. And, I wondered, you know, why did these differences exist at all? If it was, you know, a problem for their diets. And, you know, they were living in the same house, so it's like, you know, the environment was similar. So if it was, you know, nature versus nurture.
Or mom and dad, right?
Yeah, you know, they have the same genes, more or less. So so I, you know, said, why is that? And I began to research, you know, what is the science of taste and where do these differences come from?
Well, you know, with respect to the science of taste, science has given us in here in recent decades an amazing new tool to look back at the history of taste, as it were, down through the millennia. And that tool would be, of course, the ability to sequence genes. Would you tell us a little bit about this ability and its impact on how we've been able to look back?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because we can decode our own genome, and we have genes for the different tastes, salty, sweet, bitter, et cetera, that are detected by the tongue. And we can also decode, our closest relatives in the animal kingdom, chimpanzees, and see how their taste genes differ from ours. And, they also have found Neanderthal DNA, and they can decode that. So you can plot out how the sense of taste through how these genes are coded, how it evolved over millions of years. Even though once you learn that, it's kind of interesting. It raises even more questions about, what we are as humans and what our experience is and how that differs from that of animals.
And that's really the whole notion of your book. It's really not just about how we taste things. It's about like the history of the human race and all of life here on Earth, because taste is really the key to one of the keys to how we get by in the world. What role does taste play in making us the human beings that we are today?
Well, throughout the history of life, since life began eating other life, taste and smell, which are both essential components of flavor, have driven evolution. Because, when you're hunting a prey, you're going to want to be able to detect it, and you're going to want to be able to know when you eat it that it's good and satisfying. So you'll, learn to eat the same thing the next time you go hunting. So, and of course, this is sort of a linchpin in evolution, because it's, that sense of gratification and reward. Basically, as brains get bigger and bodies get more flexible and behavior grows more sophisticated, taste is always there kind of as a linchpin helping to drive that process forward. And that the sense itself grows more sophisticated. Over millions of years, we've developed more taste genes, more ability to detect more things, a more sophisticated brain to process these sensations. So it's really kind of essential to life and evolution leading up to humanity. In the emergence of human beings as human beings, with our big brains and culture and everything, it takes on an even more important role, because it's essential in when human beings learn to control fire and to cook. This also was a kind of a signal event in our evolution. At that point, our brain growth exploded, and part of that is that tastes got even better than they'd ever been in the past, because cooking food makes it taste better.
And so it's kind of like our physical beings followed our taste in development.
To a large extent, we owe our humanity to this particular sense, and it's kind of wrapped up in what it means to be human.
Well, let's take a quick look at that sense. Is that sense of taste hardwired? Is it hardware or is it software? Is it something that's hardwired into our body, like a computer has, microprocessors in it? Or is it like the software that tells the microprocessors what to do?
Well, you may not find this a satisfying answer, but it's both of those things.
Both of those.
We have the tongue can taste various basic tastes, they're called. There are five of them. Scientists believe right now, salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. Umami is a kind of savory sensation, meaty, brothy sensation.
Barbecue, right?
that's very key. Some scientists, increasing numbers, think that fat is also a basic taste, that the tongue can detect it. This means that there are little proteins on the tongue that are coded by our DNA that pick up on the particular molecules in food that set off the sensations, and our brains are hardwired to have a particular reaction to each of those. You know, if you taste something bitter, you know, you're going to frown, and it's, you know, it's a bad taste. If you taste something sweet, it's a pleasant taste. And so that, those are very old from an evolutionary standpoint, and they are hardwired.
Folks, just hold that for just a second. Folks, taste is on the table today, and we have John McQuaid, the author of Tasty, to help us walk our way through the world of taste, the history of humanity, and why some things taste good and others don't. Do stay tuned right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about taste. We're exploring the world of taste, and we're asking really weird questions like, what role did taste play in the development of our human bodies? Holy smokes. Did we taste our way into our modern body? Is that a reasonable question to ask, John McQuaid?
Taste is essential at each part of human evolution to our bigger brains, our more refined senses, to the foundation of culture. I mean, cooking, when people started cooking, they needed to have recipes for the first time because you had to render meat, you had to prepare it, you had to store some of it afterward, you had to season it. All these things, which are beyond the capacity of most animals, are things that require a bigger brain, and you know, you have to kind of plan things, and it's all planned around this the experience, the gratification, the shared meal. We're social beings, and sharing a meal is part of culture today, but it was also part of what kind of made early human bands function and how they managed to stay together and survive. So
it wasn't just people, though, either, was it? It was other animals, too. You talk about animals in the jungle having different brain sizes and different diets.
Yes. I mean, every animal has its own ecological niche. Tastes respond to that over time. You know, evolution kind of fine-tunes them. So, like, whales, for example, can't taste anything except salty things. And pandas, for example, can't taste umami, the kind of meaty thing. You know, they have no meat in their diet. Chimps chew all the time. They spend all day chewing because, you know, they eat a lot of roughage, and so their diet is kind of focused around that. And so the human diet, you know, the paleo diet, if you will, with meat and some vegetable matter and nuts and the like, our palates are kind of tuned to that naturally. But of course, you know, today things are totally different in terms of the kinds of foods that we have available.
Of course. Now, with respect to the how taste works. We were talking about it's both wired into our body as hardware, and it's also programmed by software like the culture. So how exactly does that relationship work?
Yeah, it's fascinating because, you know, we have these hardwired responses such as sweetness tasting good. But basically, from the time you start eating, you know, the experience conditions your tastes in many different ways. It conditions, you know, the aromatic component of food is very important. That's even more flexible than the taste on the tongue, for example. So everything you eat kind of conditions you one way or another. And so our brains are constantly rewiring themselves in response to our experience. So, you know, as you grow up, your sense of taste and what appeals to you is constantly changing as your brain grows and changes and responds to food. This accounts for, you know, part of why my kids have such diverse crazy taste, because in part because kids' brains are growing very fast and so many things are influencing that and their responses that, you know, it can move in almost any direction. As you become an adult, things change further. You know, adults tend to kind of open up. They abandon the pickiness. And, you know, this is partly just the brain responding to different stimuli. If your friends are eating something and you go out and they say, hey, try this, you know, you'll try it. If you mentioned food fads earlier, if there's a food fad and suddenly, you know, you're getting advertising and everyone's saying, oh, you got to try this, that also will condition you to try it. And then, you know, if you try something, you may like it. You may learn to like it. Humans have a great capacity to like stuff that tastes objectively bad. You know, bitterness is found, it tastes bad, and yet it's an essential component of beer and coffee and many different foods.
And bitterness being a really interesting presentation in your Tasty, which I hope to get to in a moment. You know, what you said about children being picky, is that a good survival mechanism?
That's what scientists think it's all about, that we are descended from hunter-gatherers who conquered the entire world, essentially living on all these habitats and colonizing new areas. And as you move into a new area, you know, there are berries and things you don't want to eat, or, you know, you need to be very careful. And this is thought to be a survival mechanism whereby your 2-year-old wandering behind you will not be popping everything into his or her mouth. And that makes a lot of sense because most kids abandon the pickiness as they get older.
As they grow in knowledge, and that would indicate that just basic intelligence plays a role too. As you grow older, we're probably more able to consider what we're eating and think about where it comes from and whatnot. Whereas when we're younger, we really don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, kids are going to like what they like, and it's very hard to kind of push them off that when they're in that I like what I like mode.
Right. You know, let's talk about our other senses and the impact our other senses play on what tastes good, for example. I like walking my dogs and watch them hunt for food, you know, as they're wandering through the woods or wherever we're at. They always approach something and smell first. They always, you know, they use their smell as a real sense. And was that, you know, one of the early tools of good taste?
The sense of smell is essential to our experience of food because in our brains, the sense of taste coming up from the tongue and the sense of smell, which is stimulated, you know, by when you chew food, aromas are released, and so you sense those, and the brain then knits these together into flavor without us really being aware that they're, in fact, separate senses operating. So the sense of smell is essential. It's probably more important than taste in our experience of food. Now, going back, you know, to dogs hunting, there's a difference between smells coming into the nose, you know, from the outside world, and those that you're detecting that are coming from food. And, you know, our brains also manage to distinguish those things. And humans, compared to dogs, we have relatively weak senses of smell. Dogs have a lot more smell receptors. They can detect just far more things and in far lower concentrations than humans in the air. Everybody knows that. However, humans, when we're tasting food, we tend to have the advantage because of the shape of our heads. The passageway from the back of the mouth up to the, you know, the nasal area is very short. This means that you get, when you're eating, you get your nasal sensors get this really strong sense from the food that other animals don't have. And so this tends to give us a supercharged sense of flavor compared, I mean, we can't interview a dog, but right. compared to other animals. So our experience of flavor when we're eating, the raw sensations, are thought to be much more powerful for us than for a lot of other animals.
We're going to hold that, come right back. We're going to talk about the notion of sweet and sight and how the two work for animals in the woods and color, what that all blends together in our taste, right back. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about sense of taste, and we're really looking at the notion of whether our taste can lead us to the promised land of good food, or is our taste so influenced by other things, like what we see on television, here on the radio, reading the newspapers, that we'll go just about anywhere and taste anything if we're told to do so. We seem to be told to do so quite often these days with various kinds of food fads. Eggs are bad. Eggs are good. Meat is bad. Meat is good. Grains are bad. Grains are good. What the heck is going on? Can our taste help us out there? And so we're looking at taste and how taste led us from the, the primordial ooze into the promised land of modern cities. And here we are, human beings with big brains. And did taste have anything to do with that? Seems to have. Is that not correct, John McQuaid, author of Tasty?
The sense of taste is kind of guiding us through this very confusing food environment that we all live in. And the information that we're bombarded with, you know, is affecting our experience. You know, if you're afraid something's going to be not good for you, you know, that'll literally affect how it tastes going down.
Well, we're talking about the sense of smell and its impact on taste, which is huge, not only for us today, but really throughout the history of human beings and other species as well. And let's talk a little bit about the sense of sweet or sight, or sense of sight, and its relation to things like sweet. Because to smell something, you have to be pretty close, unless you're a dog. You can be farther away. But what about color? You make an interesting discussion about color with respect to fruit and sweet and the birds of the jungle.
Sweetness, of course, is a very ancient sensation. A lot of animals are drawn to sugars in the environment, and sugar is relatively scarce, you know, as a kind of taste in the environment, in the natural world. In honey, for example, you'll find it, and in fruit, and a few other places, but that's basically it. And it's very energy rich, so that's why the sense of sweetness is so strong, and so many animals are drawn to this.
Because it gives you energy.
Right, precisely.
And it tastes good, it gives you energy, life is good.
Exactly. In terms of the vision element, our sense of vision is part of the sense of flavor. The brain somehow integrates all these things together. And scientists think that this, for humans, this can be traced back to ancestors of monkeys approximately 10 million years ago, developing more acute vision that enabled them to spy red fruits in a green jungle environment. Which are very rare, and if you can spot them and get to them first, that's an evolutionary advantage.
You win.
Exactly. And so the legacy of that today is, we see it, if we go to the supermarket and we see a brightly colored fruit, that's good just looking at it. Visual presentation is very important in how we experience food. If something looks good, if it's brightly colored, carefully arranged, if it sends you the right signals visually, it's going to really set the table for, in your brain for how the food is going to taste. This literally kind of shapes the sensation as you're, even before you start tasting something.
And there it is. And so if you're a bird in the forest and you can see, if you have the brain capacity to see far in the distance, you can spot that fresh, sweet fruit and get to it before anybody else. And so does that have something to do with brain size as well?
It has to do with processing of visual information, and so it does have to do with brain size. Larger in the ape family, monkeys and apes, apes of which humans are one, have this more enhanced vision. It's called three-color vision, and some species of monkeys do, but other species of monkeys and more primitive, quote unquote, primates do not have this capacity. So it is tied into our bigger brain size and our kind of social nature and ability to function as a group.
So one of the most interesting tastes of all is the taste. Well, everybody likes sweet. I mean, does anybody not like sweet? Most everybody likes sweet. Many people like the sense of umami. But the most interesting one would seem to be the taste of bitter. Why is that?
Bitterness is, there are hundreds and hundreds of compounds that have been identified as tasting bitter, and probably thousands. And this is unlike any other taste. Sweetness is basically the sensation of sugar. And there are a few different types of sugars, but just a handful. And scientists think that this is because, bitterness is a warning that something is bad for you. And there's lots of potentially poisonous things in the environment. And so our sense of bitterness is kind of tuned so broadly to detect so many different things. And it was further tuned, since we're talking evolution here, by humans colonizing all these different habitats around the world, where they're tasting different vegetables, basically, wherever they go. And, this had an effect on their survival, and it affects us today in terms of some people detect some forms of bitterness, other people cannot detect them, and some people are very sensitive to certain forms of bitterness, other people much less so. Every person is like a snowflake in this regard. They have a kind of different sensation related to the kinds of bitterness they detect and the intensity of it.
Take us to broccoli and the bush family.
Well, this is probably the most famous bitter anecdote there is, and that President George H.W. Bush, back in the early 1990s, declared that he was not going to allow broccoli to be served on Air Force One, and that his wife Barbara kept pushing broccoli at him, but he said, "I'm the President of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli." George W. Bush, interestingly, also disliked broccoli. And so it's thought that this is a genetic trait, you know, that the Bushes, at least the, the George and George H.W. and George W., shared this sensitivity to certain bitter chemicals in broccoli that was programmed by their genes.
And so it would take much more, I guess, just basic genetic intelligence to be able to... does it take more intelligence to discern good bitterness from bad bitterness? Or some people can't even taste bitterness. Is that true? If so, they'll pick up the answer when we get back from this quick break. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio Program, talking with John McQuaid, author of Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat. How does our taste affect what we eat, but also affected the development of the human body and mind? Holy smokes, right back. Well, of course, there are lots of interesting tastes out there in the world, but one of the more interesting ones, and I think it's one that was identified relatively recently, was the taste of umami. What exactly is the taste of umami, John McQuaid, author of Tasty?
It's often described as a meaty, savory sensation, and it's found in broths, in cooked meats, in cheeses, in miso soup, a lot of Asian cuisine, miso soup, kelp broth, things like that are very strong in umami. It was discovered... of course, Asian cuisine was aware of it and using it for hundreds of years, but it was discovered, the chemical basis, by a Japanese scientist about 100 years ago. And he had a big block of kelp, seaweed that's used in, to make broth and other things. And he chopped it up and he made... lots of different tests on it and basically isolated the chemical that was creating the pleasurable sensation, which was a glutamate salt, monosodium glutamate, MSG, is basically an umami chemical. From there, people learn more about it. And today it's kind of a big buzzword, umami. There's umami burger. The word conjures up this sort of mysterious, foreign, for Americans, kind of foreign sensation. So,
well, that leads me, to wonder what, with the development of MSG, how has food science learned to work with our taste to influence what we eat?
The more we learn about the sense of taste from a scientific basis, the more food corporations and also chefs, there's kind of a parallel development going on, have been able to exploit that in order to manipulate our tastes for good or for ill. So a lot of... food companies, for example, now have geneticists working for them who can, decode the sense of taste and in our genes and look at how to manipulate that on a molecular level. And that's a very powerful thing to be able to do. In fact, I'm not sure what if that's good or bad, in the long run, because there's a lot of problems in our food today.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that kind of the essence of MSG? Is that it allowed food processors to essentially take the food out of food and yet have the taste still there?
Yeah, the other thing about umami is that it is a flavor enhancer. It literally synergizes tastes and smells and enhances them in your brain. And they've done experiments that show, your brain activity is much greater with umami present if you have the same tastes and smells together than if umami is not present. So there's some kind of alchemical magic that it brings. And of course, you know, food companies said, wow, this is fantastic. And also, they were trying and have been for years to reduce the amount of salt in foods. And so many said, well, we'll just throw some MSG in there instead of salt. And, you know, that'll help. And, you know, MSG has been controversial. I think a lot of food companies have moved away from it, at least, you know, the manufactured variety in terms of looking for more natural ingredients. And, you know, it was for a long time thought to cause headaches. You know, you go to, you know, a Chinese restaurant and they'd be dosing the food with MSG and people would get headaches. However, scientists have been kind of skeptical of that. There's been no consistent scientific evidence for the Chinese restaurant hangover syndrome.
And yet, it is a big part of the management of food these days, is the science behind what we taste and how we taste things, using, you know, geneticists really to figure out how to make food that's more attractive to us. Gosh, that could take us all kinds of different directions, could it not?
Yeah, I mean, there are geneticists, there are psychologists and behavioral scientists, because food is not just a sensation, it's a social phenomenon. And as we were discussing earlier, all the senses are involved in it, you know, so the sense of vision and even hearing, you know, the crunchiness in food, that is very gratifying. And so people look at how do you engineer something so that it gives you the perfect crunch? And how do you enhance food so that it achieves the maximum pleasure in the shortest amount of time, so you'll keep eating? That's the Dorito effect.
The Dorito effect. And so they figured out, and that's the science of food these days, is how to really please the taste so that you keep eating more of their food. Well, when we get back, though, I'd like to ask John McQuaid, author of Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat, is it possible that we can, you know, use our taste in combination with our brains to figure out what's really good to eat? Or are we going to be just tricked forever into eating what they want us to eat? This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, and John McQuaid, author of Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat. Fun story, right back. Well, you know, we have this wonderful ability to look into the genes of critters that lived on Earth millions of years ago and see what they ate, really, and even how they ate. Holy smokes, we follow those genes all the way through history, and we can look at the genes of people from different parts of the world and see where they came from and how they evolved and their proclivities to eat. And so given this incredible knowledge that we have and the ability to find even more knowledge, how on earth are you and I going to survive what they want us to eat? Because they can pretty much tell what we're going to eat. I get us a little snippet of our hair, then they got us wired. So will we be able to somehow use our taste and our brain to eat what's good, or will we just eat what they want us to eat? Let's put that to John McQuaid, author of Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat. John, what say you?
Well, part of the problem today is that nutrition has been kind of cut off from taste. In other words, they've split apart. It used to be that good food tasted good. Food that was good for you tasted good. That's why good taste exists, to guide you to something that's good for you. However, we've created this kind of funhouse environment where bad food tastes good. And so, you know, what do you do about that? I mean, you need to be aware of that phenomenon and, you know, that you are being manipulated. And, of course, you know, there's a whole movement of going, you know, back to more basics in food that is more from more natural sources, that is less processed, it's the real problem comes in processed foods, which are, you know, prepared via these industrial processes that are, you know, scientifically designed to manipulate you to get you to eat and keep eating and buy and keep buying. So I think you need to just be aware of what's in your food and what it'll do to you if you eat too much of it. And also, you know, if you experience simpler pleasures in food, you can kind of reawaken that, you know, original sense of purpose to the sense of taste and flavor.
Well, what you're suggesting is that we really have to use our brains here, because if we don't, then if we just go with what tastes good, then we're going to be in following whatever they want us to do. So we really have to know, have some knowledge, do we not? We really have to educate ourselves or eat what they feed us.
That helps. I mean, one advantage that is also programmed into our nature is that we're omnivores. We like variety in food. In processed foods, you know, snack foods, a lot of that is programmed into the food. They put a lot of different tastes in a potato chip, for example.
Sure. Jalapeno potato chips.
Right, in order to kind of satisfy that urge.
You can have a whole smorgasbord in a bag of potato chips. But that really, you know, that's really clever stuff. Are we smart enough to beat that?
Yeah, I mean, collectively, I have no idea. I hope so.
I hope so for your two kids and for mine as well. John McQuaid, thank you so much for joining us on a conversation about Tasty. Folks, pick it up. It's a great read. Learn a lot about the history of the human race. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.